Okay, welcome to the deep dive. You've put together this incredible stack of sources for us diving into everything from why we dream and animal migration to the history of everyday phrases and the search for legendary lost cities.
It's quite the collection, isn't it? At first glance, these subjects seem, well, completely separate.
And that's exactly the fun part. Our mission today is to be your guides through this material. We're going to pull out the most important nuggets, helping you get informed quickly, and more importantly,
Find the connections.
exactly, finding the surprising threads that tie these seemingly unrelated areas together, hopefully sparking a few aha moments for you.
Yeah, we'll explore how history is kind of embedded in our language, how human curiosity drives that search for the unknown, how complex decision-making happens in the animal kingdom, and how fundamental processes like learning and dreaming are linked right back to our brain function.
All right, let's unpack this. Let's start with something we all interact with every single day, the words and phrases we use. It turns out many common sayings have really specific, sometimes pretty wild, historical roots.
Language is, it's like an archaeological site for history, isn't it? It just preserves these little remnants of past events, beliefs, practices.
Things we're totally unaware of when we speak them.
Right.
Like, turn a blind eye. You know,
Yeah.
deliberately ignoring something. The origin story often traces back to 1801, Battle of Copenhagen.
Ah, Nelson.
Yeah, the British naval hero Horatio Nelson, famous for having only one good eye. Yeah. So he was signaled by his superior to withdraw, but legend has it, he brought his telescope up to his bad eye and said something like, "I really do not see the signal."
Huh. And then pressed on to victory. Though, historians still debate if he actually said that or if it happened exactly that way.
Sure, but the phrase totally captures that spirit of strategic ignorance.
It really does.
Okay, or white elephant. We
Yeah.
use it for like a costly, burdensome possession.
Yeah, that one comes from Thailand, the legend there. White elephants were sacred, but incredibly expensive to keep.
So the story goes, kings would give them as gifts to rivals.
Basically, hoping the upkeep cost would ruin them.
Right, a very passive-aggressive gift.
A rather expensive way to wage economic warfare, if it's true. It just shows how things can become symbols of,
And
burden.
crocodile tears showing fake sorrow.
That one's fascinating because it's not based on actual crocodile biology at all.
No.
No, it's from a medieval belief. It got really popular through the travels of Sir John Mandeville in the 14th century. The myth claimed crocodiles cried while eating their prey.
Ah,
And
weird.
get this, the myth also said they didn't have tongues.
Oh, okay. That's just bizarre.
A strange mix of wrong biology and folklore. But the image, it was powerful. Shakespeare was using the idiom by the 16th century.
Wow. Okay, here's a grim one. Die Hard.
Oh, yeah. Originally back in the 1700s, it literally meant the condemned men who struggled the longest during hangings.
Yikes, stark image.
Very. But it's modern, meaning, strong dedication, resistance, that really solidified after the Battle of Albira in 1811.
Right, the British officer, William Inglis.
Exactly. He rallied his really badly depleted 57th Regiment, shouting something like, "Stand your ground and die hard."
And they held the line under heavy fire, earning the nickname the Diehards.
So it shifted, from literal death to a metaphor for just pure tenacity.
What about resting on laurels? That sounds ancient.
It is, goes back to ancient Greece and Rome. Laurel wreaths were symbols of achievement.
Like for athletes or generals, linked to Apollo.
Awarded at the Pythian Games, given to Roman generals. So laureates, those crowned with laurels, they could literally rest on their past glory.
But the negative meaning, getting complacent, that didn't really stick until much later.
Yeah, more like the 1800s. That's when it picked up the connotation of being overly satisfied with past successes.
Interesting. And read the Riot Act. That wasn't just a saying.
No, that was a literal thing, an actual English law from 1715.
You're kidding.
Nope. A public official actually had to read a specific section of this act to any group of more than 12 people who seemed threatening, disturbing the peace.
And then what?
They got an hour to disperse. If they didn't, force could be used. It was famously read during the Peterloo Massacre in 1819.
Wow, so next time you tell someone the Riot Act's been read, you're channeling an 18th century official facing down a mob.
Very much.
Paint the town red sounds rowdier.
Oh, it is. The most cited story points to the Marquis of Waterford in 1837. He and his friends apparently went on a massive drunken vandalism spree in Melton Mowbray, England.
And they literally.
Yeah, literally painted stuff
Yeah.
red, a toll gate, some buildings.
Okay. There are other theories, right? Something about the American West.
There are, yeah, maybe linked to brothels. But the image of literally painting things red is just so vivid, it kind of stuck.
It really does. Running amok, another one tied to a specific place.
Mm-hmm. It started as a term Europeans used in Malaysia to describe this strange mental state where tribesmen would suddenly go on these random violent sprees.
Captain Cook mentioned it.
He did, yeah. Described amok warriors in 1772. It even showed up in early psychiatric manuals.
And now it just means any kind of uncontrolled behavior.
Right. But the root is that specific, poorly understood phenomenon observed centuries ago.
Okay, here's one I love because the origin is so unexpected, by and large.
Ah, the nautical one.
Yes.
Pure sailing jargon. Large meant sailing with a good wind behind you, filling the sails.
Okay.
And by meant sailing into the wind, or as close to it as you could manage.
So by and large meant...
being able to sail well in pretty much any wind condition, whether you were sailing by the wind or large with it, traveling effectively regardless of the wind direction.
And now it just means generally, or for the most part, amazing. Our speech is full of hidden sailing tips.
It really is.
Okay, last one. The third degree. Intense questioning.
Right. There are a few theories, links to criminal codes, maybe a specific tough policeman named Burns in the 19th century.
But the most likely one.
Seems to be the Freemasons. To reach the third degree or become a master mason, candidates have to go through some pretty rigorous questioning and examinations.
Ah, okay. That fits.
It's just remarkable, isn't it, how these everyday phrases tossed around so casually contain echoes of ancient rituals, military battles, old laws, folklore.
It shows the past isn't just in books, it's literally in our mouths.
Exactly. Language itself is kind of a treasure hunt.
Which is a perfect segue. Speaking of treasure hunts, let's move to the search for actual physical lost treasures and places.
Yeah.
This next set of sources dives into legendary lost cities and how that whole search connects to something deep in human nature.
Yeah, that pull of the unknown, the curiosity, the power of these legends, you know, the mix of myth and the tiny, tantalizing possibility of actual discovery. It's fueled expeditions for centuries.
It's about uncovering secrets, right? Maybe finding something that just totally rewrites what we thought we knew.
Precisely. Like Atlantis, probably the most famous lost city.
Everyone knows the name. Plato wrote about it, what, 360 BC?
Mm-hmm. A super powerful, advanced island civilization. Destroyed by some catastrophe around 9600 BC, supposedly, and just sank into the sea.
And people are still looking, using Plato's clues, even with modern tech.
Right. You see efforts like the one involving Simcha Jacobovici and James Cameron. They found Bronze Age anchors off Spain near Gibraltar and suggested it could be related. It shows how these ancient texts still drive cutting-edge exploration.
Then there's Camelot, King Arthur's court.
Ah, yes. First pops up in 12th century French romances.
Mostly fictional, you think?
Most scholars think so, yeah. More of a symbolic setting for chivalry tales. Yeah. But people still debate where it might have been in Great Britain, still search for it, even if just for tourism or inspiration. It shows how deeply legends embed themselves.
And the lost city of Z. Percy Fawcett's obsession.
Yeah, closely tied to the El Dorado legend. Fawcett was convinced it was real, deep in the Brazilian jungle. Based on this 1753 manuscript describing a city like ancient Greece.
And he disappeared looking for it in 1925.
Which only deepened the mystery, right? Fueled even more searches. For the city and for him. It's that potent mix, old text, personal obsession, unknown dangers.
Aztlán, the legendary Aztec homeland.
Another mystery. Tied to the Nahuatl legend of seven tribes migrating from a place called Chicamostoc. It's their origin point, the land from whence we came.
But is it a real place?
That's the question. Searches have happened from western Mexico up to Utah, but its physical location or even existence is still unknown. It shows how myths can define a people's origin, even without a confirmed spot on a map.
And the Kingdom of Lyonesse, from Arthurian legend too, Tristan's home, sank beneath the waves.
This one might actually have roots in real geology. Cool. There's an account from the 14th century by William of Worcester describing land and churches submerged off Cornwall.
Really?
Yeah, it could reflect the actual coastal sinking that happened over thousands of years, turning real events into legends of lost lands.
Okay, El Dorado itself. Fascinating how that morphed from a ritual to a whole city of gold.
It started with the Muisca tribe at Lake Guatavita. Their ritual involved the king, the gilded one, covered in gold dust, throwing treasures into the lake.
And the Spanish heard about this.
And their imaginations ran wild. It became a legend of an entire city made of gold. People tried to drain the lake in the 16th century.
Did they find anything?
They found some gold near the edges, which just fueled the legend more. The main treasure, if it exists, is still down there. The lake's protected now since 1965.
But the idea of El Dorado lives on?
Oh, yeah. The search continues, just elsewhere. Shows how powerful imagination can be.
What about the Kalahari? Someone claimed to find ruins there.
Guillermo Farini, back in 1885, claimed he found ruins of a lost civilization in the desert.
And did others look?
They did. Expeditions followed in the 20th century. Even Elon Musk's grandparents were involved in some searches.
No way.
Yep. And interestingly, a search in 2016 using modern tech found what might be man-made ruins near an oasis. So maybe Farini saw something, even if he exaggerated. Modern tech revisiting old claims.
Dubai also has lost cities, but real ones, right? Like Julfar.
Exactly. Julfar wasn't legend. It was a major medieval port city. A huge trading hub in the Southern Gulf for like 1,000 years.
Trading with India, China?
Yeah, Far East China. Known from written records, but eventually it just got buried by sand dunes. Lost and forgotten until archaeologists found it again in the 1960s.
A reminder that lost can just mean buried.
Precisely.
Quivira, another one tied to Spanish explorers, looking for the seven cities of Cibola.
Right, Coronado's expedition in 1540. Unlike some others, Quivira actually got pinned to a location in Kansas by an archaeologist named Jacob Brower in the late 19th century.
Based on what?
Stone tools, mostly. Yeah. A method that got some criticism, apparently, but it was convincing enough then that they put up monuments in the early 20th century. Shows how archaeology, interpretation, and sometimes, you know, debate mixed together in these searches.
And lastly, Thule, that mythical northern island.
From Norse mythology, yeah.
Yeah.
Described as cold, somewhere between Scandinavia and Iceland. A Greek explorer, Pytheas, wrote about it way back in the 4th century BC after sailing north from Britain.
But where was it?
Still debated. Could be Norway, Shetland, Orkney, Iceland, even Greenland. Its identity is kind of fluid through history.
So this whole search for lost cities, whether they're mythical or just buried, it really highlights that deep human drive, doesn't it? To uncover the unknown, connect with the past.
Absolutely. Filling in the blank spaces on the map, both the physical map and the historical one. It reflects that innate need to understand where we came from, what came before.
It really does. Okay, so let's shift gears a bit now. From human history and myth-making to the incredible movements and complex communication happening right now in the animal kingdom. We've got sources here on animal migration and African wild dog communication.
Yeah, animal migration. It's one of nature's truly awe-inspiring spectacles, isn't it? These massive, often seasonal journeys by huge numbers of animals.
Driven by environment, food, mating.
Usually, yeah. Climate changes, finding food, breeding grounds. And it's not just random wandering. True migration, as described here, is this consistent cyclical movement, often returning to the same place or a big habitat shift tied to a life stage.
Like young fish heading out to sea.
Exactly. And it happens across almost every animal group. Birds are probably the most famous, right?
Definitely.
Around 1,800 species migrate long distances. Think about the Arctic tern. Its annual round trip is something like 19,000 kilometers.
19,000. Between the Arctic and Antarctic?
Yeah. Basically getting 2 summers a year.
That's just mind-boggling. How do they even navigate that?
It's incredibly complex. They use things like a sun compass, the Earth's magnetic field.
Yeah.
It's often triggered by changes in day length, hormone levels, like built-in GPS.
Wow. Okay. And fish migrate too.
Oh, yes. Many stay local, but hundreds of species travel huge distances. Salmon swimming upstream to spawn is a classic example. Mm. Herring and capelin in the North Atlantic make massive movements. The sardine runoff South Africa is another huge event. And we have a term for fish that migrate between salt and freshwater. Diadromus.
Mammals, too, obviously. Wildebeest in the Serengeti.
Iconic, yeah. Mexican free-tailed bats travel long distances. And it's crucial for many whales and dolphins, the cetaceans.
What about humans? Does our movement count as migration in the same way?
Generally, no. Human migration is usually about changing residence permanently, not that annual round trip tied to seasons. Exceptions might be traditional transhuman.
Moving livestock seasonally.
Right, between grazing areas and nomadic movements. But not quite the same biological drive as animal migration.
And it's not just the big animals. Sea turtles migrate huge distances to breed.
And the hatchlings. They make these amazing journeys out to the open sea right after hatching using the magnetic field to navigate.
And those Christmas Island red crabs.
Oh, that's spectacular. A mass annual movement from the forest down to the sea to breed. They're land crabs, but they breed with gills that need to stay moist.
That's another challenge.
For sure. Females release eggs at sea, the larvae drift, and then eventually come back to land. It's an incredible cycle.
Before we had GPS tags and stuff, how did people explain where these animals went?
Well, that's where you get some amazing folklore, like the idea that barnacle geese grew from barnacles on driftwood.
Seriously?
Yep. Or that swallows hibernated underwater, or maybe inside trees over winter.
Wow. Trying to make sense of the disappearance.
Exactly. Based on what they could observe. Now, technology like tags, GPS, geolocators, it gives us real data on the routes, the timing, the triggers.
Speaking of complex mechanisms, let's talk about these African wild dogs. This study on their communication during movement is fascinating.
It really is. They have these social rallies before they move as a group. But not every rally actually leads to them going anywhere.
Okay.
And this study found that audible, rapid nasal exhalations, basically, sounds like sneezes, play a crucial role.
Sneezes as communication, that seems odd.
It does sound odd. But the researchers found that the number of these sneezes predicts whether the group will actually decide to depart successfully.
So more sneezes means they're more likely to go.
Exactly. They call it a variable quorum threshold. There's a minimum number of sneezes needed for the group to decide to move.
A quorum of sneezes.
Pretty much. And what's really cool is that the minimum number needed is lower if a dominant dog initiated the rally.
So the leaders have more clout, but...
But. And this is key. This sneezing mechanism can actually override the preference of the dominant individuals if enough subordinate dogs vote by sneezing.
So it's like actual voting, sneezes or votes.
That's the interpretation, yeah. A form of negotiation or democratic process shaping the group's decision. It's pretty sophisticated.
That's incredible. Group consensus matters, even overriding the boss sometimes.
Mm-hmm. The study notes this kind of sneezing hasn't really been documented as a major communication signal in wild dogs before. Similar sounds in other camids are usually for threat or alarm.
But these sneezes aren't like that.
No, they don't seem to happen with anxious body language.
Yeah.
It seems specific to this decision-making context.
And it's similar to things seen in other social animals.
Yeah, like vocal coordination before moving off in meerkats and gorillas. It's a fantastic example of how complex social dynamics can work through seemingly simple, unexpected behaviors.
It reminds you that communication isn't just language, right? It's all these signals we're still figuring out.
Absolutely. Tied to survival, coordination, group cohesion.
Okay, so from history, in our words, the drive to find lost places, animal journeys, wild dog democracy, let's bring it back right inside our own heads. To the brain itself, how we learn, process things, connect, looking at dreaming, playing, and laughing.
Right. This brings us to the sources on dreaming, toys, and laughter. Let's start with that really interesting Tufts theory on why we dream, Eric Hole's overfitted brain hypothesis.
Overfitted, like in machine learning.
Exactly like that. In AI, overfitting is when a model gets too good at the specific data it was trained on, and then it can't handle new, unfamiliar situations well. It loses its ability to generalize.
Okay. And programmers fix that how?
They often add random data or noise during the training process to stop the model from becoming too specialized.
So Hole's idea is that dreams do that for our brains.
That's the hypothesis. Our daily lives can get pretty routine, repetitive.
Yeah.
Like, say, filling out spreadsheets all day. Dreams, with their weird, bizarre, disconnected storylines, inject discord or noise into that routine input.
And the point of that noise is?
To stop our brains from getting overfitted to just our daily grind. It helps maintain flexibility, improves our ability to generalize what we know, and helps us tackle new problems.
Maybe that's why you sometimes sleep on a problem and wake up with an answer. Your brain got a dose of helpful randomness.
They could be part of it. The theory also gets some backing from who dreams. Mammals and birds, species that do a lot of learning from parents and their environment, they seem to dream.
But reptiles.
Reptiles, which rely much more on innate, hardwired behaviors, don't seem to dream in the same way. Suggests an evolutionary link between dreaming and complex learning.
The theory even goes further, suggesting fiction, art, could be like artificial dreams.
Yeah, that they provide these structured but often unusual or jarring experiences that might also help prevent overfitting and boost generalization. Maybe even more effectively than random dream content sometimes, if it's a well-crafted story.
So our love of stories could be tied to keeping our brains flexible.
It's a fascinating possibility. And that connects really well to the source in the history of toys, because toys are all about learning through play.
Right, and that goes way back. Prehistoric times, we find little dolls, mini tools, animal figures.
Everywhere. Indus Valley had toy carts and whistles thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
Egypt, Greece, Rome all had toys.
And play is just crucial for kids, isn't it?
Absolutely essential. It's how they figure out who they are, develop physical skills, learn cause and effect, practice getting along with others, build skills for adult life.
But it's not just for kids. Adults use play and toys, too.
We do. For social bonding, teaching, maybe keeping memories sharp, exercise for mind and body, even just decoration sometimes.
What are some ancient examples?
Egyptian dolls had wigs and moving limbs. Greek and Roman dolls made of wax or terracotta. Bows and arrows, yo-yos. Greek girls apparently sacrificed their dolls before getting married, like a symbol of growing up.
Mm.
And the oldest mechanical puzzle we know of is Greek, from the 3rd century BC.
Wow. So, like dreaming, play seems like another key way our brains learn, adapt, process things, using creativity and interaction.
Definitely. Which brings us to something maybe even more fundamental and very social. Laughter. Why do we laugh?
This source says it's universal, right? Found in every human culture.
It is, and it's not just about feeling good, though it does that.
Endorphins.
Yeah, laughter's linked to endorphin release. It boosts mood, cuts stress, might even help the immune system.
But the social part is huge.
Hugely important. Laughter signals connection. It affirms you share an experience or a value with someone. It just greases the wheels of communication and bonding. Research shows you're something like 30% more likely to laugh if you're with other people.
30%.
Yeah. And a PEAT scan study found that social laughter specifically ramped up pleasure, endorphins, and even pain tolerance. It's a powerful social glue.
The source mentions therapeutic uses, too.
It does. How laughter can help with things like depression, anxiety, improving self-esteem, social skills.
And it involves specific brain areas.
Mm-hmm. The frontal lobe and motor cortex handle the physical act of laughing. But processing subtle humor, getting the joke, involves regions like the right frontotemporal area. Damage there can mess with humor appreciation.
But the brain can adapt.
It can, yeah.
Yeah.
Therapy can help build new pathways. Laughter really connects our emotions, brain function, and that deep need for social connection. A simple act with profound roots.
So when you pull it all together, looking back across this whole deep dive.
Yeah, from history hidden in words, the human quest for lost places, migrating animals, sneezing dogs.
Yeah.
Right up to dreaming, playing,
yeah.
Laughing. You really start to see these remarkable patterns emerge.
We've looked at how language is like a living archive, how our search for the unknown shows this core human drive, how complex systems guide behavior across species.
And how essential things like dreaming, playing, and laughing are tied right into how we learn, adapt, and connect with each other.
It reinforces that idea that exploring seemingly unconnected sources can reveal these unexpected threads. But insights into us, communication, life itself.
Yeah, it suggests that there are these fundamental principles about processing information, communicating, adapting, social interaction that just show up in countless ways all across the biological world, from a tiny phrase origin to a massive migration, even inside our sleeping brains.
Well, we hope this journey through these sources has given you maybe a fresh perspective on things you encounter every day.
Yeah, whether it's a phrase you hear someone use or news about some discovery or just sharing a laugh with a friend.
So here's a final thought for you to maybe chew on as we wrap up. The next time you find yourself really stuck on a complex problem, or maybe the next time you have a particularly weird or vivid dream, could it just be your brain doing its job? You know, introducing a bit of necessary noise to keep itself sharp, flexible, and ready for whatever new challenge comes your way.